Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Good evening, everybody. It is 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 50th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. So happy golden anniversary to us. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on Blog Talk Radio as the show is happening. I'm going to pause real quick for a technical thing I need to work on, and I will be right back to you guys.
I shot the sheriff, but I did not shoot the deputy. I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot the deputy.
Okay, guys, thanks for that and your patience. So before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. Pardon me. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Lovely as always, Dr. Mathis, and if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, that was the intro and end of a Skid Row song called I Remember You. So given that we're going to be talking about memory and memory loss and all things related to that, I thought it'd be kind of a cutesy little intro for us this evening.
Excellent. And as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled I Don't Remember, with a nod to Peter Gabriel. I do actually remember. That is the actual show title. Before we begin tonight's topic discussion, though, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so I thought it would be kind of cool tonight to talk about something that's not usually a hot topic, per se, and that is something that Lars Ulrich sort of side-noted referenced many years ago when the rock and roll community decided to, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame decided to nominate the best heavy metal act. And if you may remember that kind of fiasco, the band that they were up against, obviously Metallica was there and honestly should have won the award by anybody's, excuse me, delusional imagination. And they lost it to Jethro Tull, which, you know, Tull does some cool stuff. And I love Tull. They're one of my favorite bands. But they're definitely not heavy metal, but that just shows you the cluelessness of the folks at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so Ulrich made some nasty comment, basically saying anybody that's got a flute in their band can't be, you know, hard rock heavy metal. So I decided to, remembering that comment, you know, pun intended, I decided to bring up a bunch of popular and rock and heavy metal songs and bands that actually do have flutes in them. So, yeah. So among those, and like, and now again, the vast majority of these are not heavy metal, and I would, in general, concur with Lars's comment, although I thought it was kind of crass of him to do so, but what do I know? So among the bands and songs that probably most of our listeners know or at least have heard of, and certainly many of these are what I would call pop bands or whatever. So back in the day, the Association had a band called had a song called Along Comes Mary, which had a flute in it. The Beastie Boys have a song called Sure Shot that has a flute in it. Hocus Pocus, which is definitely a hard rock band, did a song called Focus, in which their keyboard player, in addition to do yodeling, which is also not something you hear very often, played a flute solo in that piece of music that was a huge, huge hit. The band Traffic, Steve Winwood's band, had many songs that had flutes in it because Chris Wood was their, you know, resident flautist and saxophonist, and including in John Barleycorn and 40,000 Headmen and Freedom Rider. The Guess Who had a song called Undone, which was written by Randy Bachman, that had a flute in it. Rare Earth had a song back in the day called Born to Wander, which had a flute in it. Both Camel, which is a progressive rock, hard-edged progressive rock band, has several albums that have flutes in it. As we mentioned before, Tull, Ian Anderson, the flautist, vocalist, acoustic guitar player in Tull, plays flute on a boatload of stuff, including Living in the Past, Cross-Eyed Mary, My God, Locomotive Breath, many of which are on one of my all-time favorite records ever, which is Aqualung. Grand Funk Railroad, back in the day, I'm Your Captain. Donovan, acoustic guy, There Is a Mountain. Mamas and Papas, California Dreamin'. The Beatles, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away and Fool on the Hill. King Crimson, definitely a rock band. I Talked to the Wind off their very first recording when Greg Lake was with them. Canned Heat, Going Up the Country. Moody Blues, Night in White Satin. The Rolling Stones, definitely a rock band. Ruby Tuesday. John Mayall, very famous British godfather of British blues. The entire Turning Point album and many other stuff. Dan Fogelberg, really awesome acoustic, pop acoustic guy, had two recordings with Tim Weisberg, who was a really good flautist, twin sons and twin sons of different mothers, one and two. Simon and Garfunkel, El Condor Paso, which is off the Bridge Over Troubled Waters recording. Firefall, You Are the Woman. Heart, which is definitely a rock band. Keep My Love mm-hmm. Alive, and several things, Dreamboat Annie, and several things off their first record. Nocturnal Mortem, which is a Nazi black metal band, has a flute player. Believe it or not. Chicago Transit Authority, Color My World. Blodwin Pig, which is an old school blues rock band, and they had a shoot ton of both harmonica and flute in their stuff, particularly in the Head Rings Out recording. Bong, which is an acid rock band, has a regular flautist in their band. Madford mm-hmm. Band, back in the day, the Mighty Quinn. Men at Work, Colin Hay's band, Down Under. Emerson, Lake and Palmer, C'est la vie. Oasis, Gas Panic, has a flute in it. The Cardigans, Sick and Tired. Marshall Tucker Band, Take the Highway, Can't You See, Heard It in a Love Song. David Bowie, and I'm pronouncing it correctly according to the English pronunciation, most of you know it as Bowie. Moonage Daydream. Marvin Gaye, which is definitely not rock. Stubborn Kind of Fellow. Boss Skaggs, Lowdown. Eric Burdon and War, which is clearly not rock, but still pop music. Spill the Wine. Beach Boys, Field Flows. The Style Council, definitely not rock, but I'm just telling you, there's a shoot ton of flutes in here. How She Threw It All Away, Saint Etienne, Nothing Can Stop Us, Nicolette Larson, A Lot of Love back in the day, Genesis, Firth of Fifth, Albert Hammond, kind of a pop guy back in the day, It Never Rains in Southern California, Van Morrison, Moon Dance, Van McCoy, Do the Hustle, which is clearly not rock, nor is Carl Douglas, Kung Fu Fighting. What a song that was. The Nationals, yeah. So Far Around the Bend, and then Gravy Train and Jade Warrior, two bands that also have flute players. So certainly, while only a small portion of these would be considered hard rock and or heavy metal, there are flutes in hard rock and heavy metal, Lars, so get over it. And I do understand your anger and your frustration, because that you guys got robbed, and I'm the first to tell you that. But having said that, yes, Martha, there are flutes in pop and rock music. So there you go.
Fair enough. Okay, thank you for that. So they're hot, Lars. I know you're not listening, but that's cool. Anyhow, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room all night throughout the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, so tonight's show is called I Don't Remember. It is about memory and our relationship with it. From everyday forgetfulness to problems with aging, things from medications, pathologies, or stressors. We'll talk about tips and tricks to improve one's memory, the fairly new topic of genetic memory, mass group memory, and more. History, recall, revisionist history, caregivers and doctors not taking this seriously, when to panic, and when is it quote-unquote normal. So tonight, we're going to break this down into, first, neurotypical memory, well, basically what is the baseline here. Second, causes of memory loss and conditions where it's common. I will let you guys know there are dozens of these, if not hundreds, and I just picked out a couple that I wanted to talk about in specific because they're talked about a lot in pop culture, but most of the time incorrectly, and I'm even guilty of this, so I thought it was important to get that straight. Number three is going to be other topics related to memory. A little bit about group memory, Mandela effect, history, the telephone game, caregivers, and so forth. And last, tips to improve your memory and resources. I did get too many of those, but we can talk about that stuff. So before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you want to add before we jump in.
There was, but I can't remember. Ba-doom. Okay, don't quit your day job, Doc.
Yes,
yeah, right.
Please don't.
Okay. And on that note, we should move on.
Okay. So neurotypical memory. This will be, how memories work, long-term versus short-term memory, which is one of the things everybody gets wrong, especially me, I found out. So what is memory? And the source for these notes is Stages of Memory, Encoding, Storage, and Retrieval by Saul McLeod. It was published in 2013, and I got this from simplypsychology.org/memory-html. For psychologists, the term memory covers three important aspects of information processing. First is memory encoding. When information comes into our memory system from sensory input, it needs to be changed into a form that the system can cope with so that it can be stored. Think of this as similar to changing your money into a different currency when you travel from one country to another. In memory encoding, there are three basic ways that we receive the data. First is visual, pictures of stuff, things we can see. Second is acoustic, aural sound. And three is semantic, or the meanings of things. B, the second part of information processing, is memory storage. This concerns the nature of memory stores, i.e. where the information is stored, how long the memory lasts for, duration, how much can be stored at any time, capacity, and what kind of information is held. And then the third aspect is memory retrieval. This refers to getting information out of storage. If we can't remember something, it might be because we are unable to retrieve it. This kind of touches on short and long-term memory, which we're going to address in a minute. So short-term and long-term memory. Short-term memory, sometimes STM, is the second stage of the multi-store memory model proposed by the Atkinson-Shiffrin report. There's a word missing here, pardon me. The duration of STM seems to be 15 to 30 seconds. This is something I totally screwed up for pretty much all my adult life. So I thought you guys might find that really interesting because I thought it was much longer than that. It is literally a few seconds. Sometimes, a few episodes ago, we talked about Hollywood portrayals of different pathologies. And you've seen Hollywood portrayals of people that have memory problems. I know that was the entire premise of 50 First Dates. And there was a guy in the hospital in that movie who literally every 15 seconds was reintroducing himself to the same people over and over again. That's actually Hi, guys. I beg your pardon, but my phone just decided to kick me off the air. So I'm going to go back to what I was saying a second ago because I'm not quite sure where it cut me off, and I want you guys to be able to hear the whole sentence. So what I was saying is about short-term memory. The duration seems to be about 15 to 30 seconds, and the capacity is about 7 items. And short-term memory is stored and retrieved sequentially, which basically means, like, if you get a list of things and you're trying to remember it, it helps you if you do them in the order that you got them in the first place. That seems to be easier for people. Short-term memory has three key aspects. First is limited capacity. As we said earlier, about only 7 items roughly can be stored at any one time. B, limited duration. Storage is very fragile, and information can be lost with distraction or passage of time. And C, encoding, primarily acoustic, even translating visual information into sounds. Now, long-term memory, LTM, the final stage of the multi-store memory model proposed by the Atkinson-Shiffrin, again, paper, word is missing, providing the lasting retention of information and skills. Long-term memory is stored and retrieved by association. Theoretically, the capacity of long-term memory could be unlimited, the main constraint on recall being accessibility rather than availability. Duration might be a few minutes, or it could be a lifetime. Types of long-term memory. One of the earliest and most influential distinctions of long-term memory was proposed by Tolving in 1972. He proposed a distinction between episodic, semantic, and procedural memory, and all of these are long-term memory aspects. Procedural memory is a part of the long-term memory that is responsible for knowing how to do things, like skills. Sometimes you haven't done something for a very long time, and all of a sudden you pick it up. It's just like riding a bike. That's where that comes from. The second one is semantic memory. Semantic memory is a part of the long-term memory responsible for storing information about the world. This includes knowledge about the meaning of words as well as general knowledge or data. And the third is episodic memory, which is a long-term memory responsible for storing information about events or episodes that we have experienced in our lives. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else that you want to bring up here.
Yeah, the first stage before it goes to short-term is a thing called working memory, which is what you're doing in the moment, juggling a bunch of different stuff and making decisions on what you're going to try to quote-unquote remember. So think of it like you've got a temporary holding capacity, and then is it important enough for you to shift it to short-term memory after a few seconds? Then it goes to short-term, and then you have to encode it correctly to get it into long-term, because long-term, as you accurately stated, is anything over 30 seconds. So to do it in long-term, what you have to do when you're in short-term, particularly if you want to remember it for really, really long times, you have to use a process called elaborate rehearsal. So you have to translate the data, whether it's iconic visual or auditory data or tactile data or whatever, into something that means something to you and store it in a way that that's meaningful to you so that you can come back and retrieve it. So if you have a break early on, like your working memory isn't that great, and so you, then you move it from working to short-term, obviously your short-term is going to be a little funky, and then when you move it from short-term to long-term, it's going to be really funky. So earlier in that chain that you run into an OBF, organic brain fart, the earlier you have a problem, don't drive this at home, these are professional terms, the more contaminated your memory becomes, even at the outset, providing you don't have any like major stuff going on. And so this is one reason that you see folks with ADHD often having memory issues, because they can't focus long enough to get the accurate data in, or a lot of them can't, in working memory, so they store it inaccurately in short term, and then by the time it gets to long term, it's pretty much not even the same stuff, particularly if they don't have a coding strategy. So, and that's true of anybody, by the way, not just ADHD people, but ADHD people tend to be more susceptible to that. But you see people who have memory loss, it's because, and they don't have some organic problem causing that. It's because they haven't encoded the data properly in a meaningful enough way. And then you have to rehearse it as you're doing it, talking to yourself in your head so that you can get it into your brain, kind of like really etched into your neural pathways, so to speak.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Sure.
So the next part we want to talk about is a few of the causes of memory loss and conditions where it's common. And again, as I mentioned earlier, there are so very many of these, but we're going to just focus on a few that are commonly talked about. So there are many different factors which can affect someone's memory temporarily or permanently. And a few of these are aging, distraction or inability to focus, fatigue, medications or supplements, various pathologies, pregnancy. And I separated this one out because you can be healthy and pregnant, and people talk about pregnancy fog, or stress and anxiety is the last one. And so here are some of the more commonly known psychological and physiological conditions in which memory loss is frequently a symptom. And I have just a couple here that I want to talk about. This first one, the source is Memory Loss, When to Seek Help, was published last year, June 27, 2017, at the Mayo Clinic. And the first part is on aphasia. And this often happens, it's a specific kind of memory loss to do with vocabulary, and I'm going to explain how these break down. Again, this is another one of those things where I was using terms slightly incorrectly, and so possibly some of you have been as well. So stay with me on this, and I'll see if I can walk you through it. So aphasia is an inability to comprehend and formulate language because of damage to specific brain regions, usually from a stroke or blunt head trauma. And there can be other causes, but these are typically the first two that come to mind. This damage is typically caused by a cerebral vascular accident, stroke, or head trauma. However, these are not the only possible causes. To be diagnosed with aphasia, a person's speech or language must be significantly impaired in one or several of the four communication modalities following acquired brain injury or have significant decline over a short time period, progressive aphasia. The four communication modalities are auditory comprehension, verbal expression, reading and writing, and functional communication. Now, there's a subheader to this called anomia. So aphasia is best, Dr.
Yeah, Messick, so for the listeners who don't know, I have anomia, so that's why I'm giggling.
Yes. And I'm giggling because I found out because of Dr. Mathis's anomia that what I was referring to as aphasia is anomia on my part as well. And let me explain how that works. So aphasia is best thought of as a collection of different disorders rather than a single problem. One of the more commonly known types is often used incorrectly by lay people to describe all types of aphasia. And you know, a lot of people react differently to the same injury. So like you could have a stroke and you would have aphasia, but you might not have anomia. You might have some other stuff. Most lay people don't know better. This is anomia or anomic aphasia. It is where an individual has word retrieval failures and cannot express the words they want to say, especially nouns and verbs. Anomia is a deficit of expressive language. Individuals with aphasia who display anomia can often describe an object in detail and maybe even use hand gestures to demonstrate how the object is used, but cannot find the appropriate word to name the object, even if they already knew it. It just won't come out. So now you know this, and aphasia has other categories, but we only have an hour tonight, so I didn't want to get into all of those because I'd be taking up half the show with just one aspect of a pathology. So there you guys go. If you need the Mayo Clinic link so you can look up some more stuff, let me know. Message me on the Facebook page or something, or email us from the website. So the next part I want to talk about is from the same page, is dementia. And this is another one where people interchange some terms that don't quite work that way, so I'm going to try to straighten that out. So the word dementia is an umbrella term used to describe a set of symptoms which can include impairment in memory, reasoning, judgment, language, and other thinking skills. Dementia usually begins gradually, worsens over time, and impairs a person's abilities in work, social interactions, and relationships. Often, memory loss that disrupts your life is one of the first or more recognizable signs of dementia. Other early signs might include asking the same questions repeatedly, forgetting common words when speaking, mixing words up, for example, saying bed instead of table, taking longer to complete familiar tasks, such as following a recipe, misplacing items in inappropriate places, such as putting a wallet in a kitchen drawer, getting lost while walking or driving in a familiar area, having changes in mood or behavior for no apparent reason. Diseases that cause progressive damage to the brain and consequently result in dementia can include, but are no means limited to, Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common cause of dementia, and people use Alzheimer's and dementia interchangeably. I have been guilty of that. So it is a subset of the blanket umbrella of dementia. The others include vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, and Lewy body dementia. That's L-E-W-Y. So when should you be concerned? When to see your doctor? If you're concerned about memory loss, see your doctor. There are tests to determine the degree of memory impairment and diagnose the cause. Your doctor is likely to ask you questions. It's good to have a family member or friend along to answer some questions based on observations. Questions might include, when did your memory problems begin? What medications, including prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, and dietary supplements, do you take and in what doses? Have you recently started a new drug? What tasks do you find difficult? What have you done to cope with memory problems? How much alcohol do you drink? Have you recently been in an accident, fallen, or injured your head? Have you recently been sick? Do you feel sad, depressed, or anxious? Have you recently had a major loss, a major change, or a stressful event in your life? And here I will pause, and I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else you'd like to bring up.
Yeah, that's thank you. What I tell people is that are trying to discern between other forms of dementia and Alzheimer's, I tell people dementia is sort of forgetting, and Alzheimer's is, you know, if you, so the example I use is if you have a remote control and you forget how to use it, that's dementia. If you forget what the heck the remote control is and what it's used for, that's Alzheimer's. I know that sounds funny, but that's kind of the quick and dirty, common layperson stuff to differentiate the Alzheimer's variety of dementias. The other thing I want to really emphasize is people do not realize how impactful depression and anxiety are on somebody's memory. They are huge contributors to memory issues, and people really underestimate the severity of those once you have a clinically depressed or clinically anxious condition, including post-traumatic stress disorder or acute stress disorder or whatever. The other thing is there are so many medications that have a secondary side effect of potentially secondary side effect of memory loss. And what makes them even worse is when you're on polypharmacy or on more than one or two medications, and then you have this thing called interaction effects sometimes, where the medications interact with each other that result in memory loss, or they potentiate each other, which means they make each one of them makes the other one stronger, if you will, a higher dosage than they would alone. And that can sometimes cause all kinds of stuff that include memory loss. Most people know that a variety of recreational drugs, including alcohol and Rufinol and a lot of the barbiturates and benzos cause memory loss, and so do certain sleeping pills. So you really, you know, in the words of one of my heroes, you have to be very, very careful. Yawning medication. So you got to be really careful with that stuff, and always, you know, whoever you go to, be sure whoever you're using as your healthcare professional, whether it's a physician, psychiatrist, whatever, be sure that you educate them on everything you're doing, and you definitely do not want to mix recreational drugs ever with pharmaceutical drugs. A bad idea. Or, and for that matter, a lot of vitamins, because if you're on, let's say, vitamin B supplements, which are usually good for a variety of things, including stress. Alcohol destroys vitamin B. So if you're doing a lot of alcohol and you're taking vitamin B, you're basically not doing yourself any good. So you got to really, really watch this kind of stuff. So.
Got it. Good. Okay. Thank you for that. All right. So the next part that we're going to talk about is a couple of other topics that are just related to the process of memory. So the first one is caregivers, and there's some aspects that are both about the caregiver and the charge of the caregiver. So whether the caregiver is a medical professional or a family member, there can be serious issues when their charge has memory loss. A variety of conflicts can arise from honest frustrations and mistakes to accusations of wrongdoing, both rightfully so and fabricated from either side. False memory. On the patient's part, often this is a variant of confabulation, which is a false memory created to resolve a nonsensical scenario. This is the same phenomenon as is in play with the Mandela effect, which we will cover shortly. Truth. Occasionally, there are caregivers, both pro and family, who actually are taking advantage of this situation to sneak or steal something out from under the patient. This makes processing who is at fault very difficult. And part of what we're talking about is that a lot of times when patients get dementia, one of the things they commonly do is accuse people of things because they've forgotten something. Like they'll put their purse in a safe place, but it's not a normal place, and they forget all about it. So the nurse stole my purse. You know, this kind of thing is very common. And unfortunately, also, when you have patients like that and some of your caregiver staff is not quality or not high quality, they will take advantage of the fact that that person has dementia and steal the purse, because who's going to believe them? So that kind of makes it worse, because sometimes it's not a lie, and it's really hard to slog through that and figure out which end of the dog to believe there. Next thing I want to talk about with caregivers is impulses, boundary transgressions, and impulse control. Often when the memory starts to erode, that part of the brain seems related to our impulse control and our sense of what is appropriate. Patients often speak with a damaged or completely absent filter. It's also likely that the disease will cause significant damage to the left side of your loved one's brain first. This is the side that keeps track of vocabulary and higher speech functions. The right side of the brain is a side that helps people to engage in social chit-chat and keep the rhythm of speech, and is generally not as affected as the left side. And P.S., the right side of the brain is where you learn something. Sure.
Part of the reason that you have impulse control problems is because one of the structures that has memory is the amygdala hippocampus, the limbic system, which is the seat of emotional regulation. So the hippocampus is both a memory structure and an impulse control with emotional structure. And that's why you see, a lot of times you'll see Alzheimer's patients getting really aggressive, because they're having damage to that area. So not only can they not remember, they have emotional dysregulation. They're more prone to emotional dysregulation because of that.
Got it. Okay, so my suspicion was correct. I just did not know the body part to gesture at. So thank you for that.
And, oh, sure.
Also, as I was adding at the end, is a little bit of a giggle. I found out the right side of the brain is where you store things like cuss words, which is often why you get a lot of that, you know, F-bombs and everything else when somebody's in high dementia.
Yeah, and even when you're not me.
So, yes. The reason that this podcast and this show is rated R, there's a reason for that. It's for your safety.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is group memory. So collective memory is the shared pool of knowledge and information in the memories of two or more members of a social group. The English phrase, quote, collective memory, and the equivalent French phrase, la mémoire collective, appeared in the second half of the 19th century. The philosopher and sociologist Maurice Halbwach, H-A-L-B-W-A-C-H, and apologies if I mispronounced that, analyzed and advanced the concept of the collective memory in the book La Mémoire Collective, which was published in 1950. Collective memory can be shared, passed on, and constructed by large and small social groups. Examples of these groups could include a government or popular culture, among others. Related to this, transactive memory is a psychological hypothesis first proposed by Daniel Wegener in 1985 as a response to earlier theories of, quote, group mind, such as groupthink. A lot of us have heard that term. A transactive memory system is a mechanism through which groups collectively encode, store, and retrieve knowledge. Transactive memory was initially studied in couples and families where individuals had close relationships, but was extended to teams, larger groups, and organizations to explain how they develop a group mind, a memory system that is more complex and potentially more effective than any of its individual constituents. A transactive memory system includes memory stored in each individual, the interactions between memory within the individuals, as well as the processes that update this memory. Transactive memory, on the other hand, is merely the shared storage of knowledge. And this is from the wiki on that. The next thing I want to talk about is the psychology community and memory research. I thought this was important to point out. A large part of the research on memory is based on experiments conducted in laboratories. Psychologists use the term ecological validity to refer to the extent to which the findings of research studies can be generalized to other settings. An experiment has high ecological validity if its findings can be generalized, that is, applied or extended to settings outside the laboratory. It is often assumed that if an experiment is realistic or true to life, then there's a greater likelihood that its findings can be generalized. And parenthetically, there's a portion of the psych community that feels that memory research is low ecological validity, because so much of it is done in the lab and not out in the wild. The next thing I want to talk about is confabulation, which we mentioned earlier, or otherwise often popularly known as the Mandela Effect. So back on episode 14 of this show, which was February 8th of last year, 2017, we did a show dedicated to confabulation, informally known as the Mandela Effect, because of a famous iteration of the pathology involving arguments about remembering that Nelson Mandela died decades before he eventually actually did, which was fairly recently. Confabulation has no entry as a pathology in either the DSM-5 or the ICD-10, and I don't think the 11 either. Source for this is Wikipedia and Rational Wiki. In psychiatry, confabulation is a disturbance of memory defined as a production of fabricated, distorted, or misinterpreted memories without the conscious intention to deceive. Individuals who confabulate are generally confident about their recollections, despite contradictory evidence. Confabulation is distinguished from lying, as there is no intent to deceive, and the person may be unaware the information is false, at least until presented with empirical evidence.
And that's why it's not considered a disorder.
Yes. Okay, that's a very good point.
Right. But more of a defense mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. The source of this next part is from R. Joseph, 86, Confabulation and Delusional Denial, Frontal Lobe and Lateralized Influences. And this is from the Journal of Clinical Psych, volume 42. So confabulation is filling in gaps of memory or conscious knowledge with erroneous information. The confabulator often appears to be unable to recognize the erroneous nature or absurdity of his statements, even in the face of painfully seemingly apparent contradictory evidence. Presumably, there is no conscious attempt on the part of the confabulator to deceive or lie. He apparently believes his own misstatements, which are reported with rock-like certitude. And that was on page 508 of the report. So the next thing I want to talk about is stuff that we recall from our childhood, the telephone game, which many of us have played. So this is from a post called The Telephone Game Phenomenon, Your Memory is Like the Telephone Game, published by the National Science Foundation, but the source is a study at Northwestern University in September of 2012. Quote, a memory is not simply an image produced by time traveling back to the original event. It can be an image that is somewhat distorted because of the prior times you remember it, says Donna Bridge, a postdoctoral fellow at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and lead author of the paper on the study recently published in the Journal of Neuroscience. And when they say recently, it means 2012. Bridge did the research while she was a doctoral student in the lab of Ken Paller, P-A-L-L-E-R, a professor of psychology at Northwestern in the Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. Quote, your memory of an event can grow less precise, even to the point of being totally false with each retrieval. The reason for this distortion, Bridge says, is the fact that human memories are always adapting. Memories aren't static, she noted. If you remember something in the context of a new environment and time, or if you are even in a different mood, your memories might integrate the new information, end quote. Other quote, this study shows how memories normally change over time, sometimes becoming distorted, Paller has noted. When you think back to an event that happened to you long ago, say your first day of school, you may actually be recalling information you retrieved about that event at some later time and not from the original event, end quote. And here I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything else you want to add.
Yeah, and the reason, you know, again, that it's colored is because the hippocampus is also the seat of emotional expression. So if you have a strong emotion in the moment, that may color your memory of it, and then that becomes part of the memory that then is now false.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It's a complicated dilly. This is not some simple thing like most people think it is. It really isn't.
Exactly. And that's why I picked that to share with people tonight. You know, I found it fascinating.
Choice.
There are some life anecdotes of mine that I like to recount at different moments. And there's a few in particular that I realize over time I've been retelling slightly differently over the years. And of course, you don't want to be robotic and read it like a script or anything. But I've always started wondering, after this many retellings, have I screwed something up? And I used to not worry about it, but now I've actually made myself a little anxious about that.
Yeah, I heard that totally.
Nope. Okay, so the last part is tips to improve memory. And this is not just la-la-la tips to make you more efficient or like one of these things you see on LinkedIn or Cosmo or, you know, whatever. These are memory tips in a more serious kind of a way, not just a flippant sort of a way. So this is from How Memory Works and Six Tips to Improve It by Sabrina Steirwalt, PhD, the Everyday Einstein. And this is from October 9th of 2017. It was published in Men's Health, but it comes from quickanddirtytips.com. It's a cheesy website, but the person who wrote it is not a pop psychology person, you know, their actual doctor. So how to improve your memory. Here are a few tips on how we might improve our ability to remember information. And please note, there are some pathologies in which this is way too small of a thing. You know, it requires medical intervention of a different sort. But if you're just having some day-to-day issues that you want to work through, then this is the sort of advice we can give you. So first, assign an importance to a memory that you want to keep. We tend to remember things in proportion to how important they are to us. Second, recent studies have shown that drawing a piece of information can help that memory stick around, although scientists are not completely sure why this happens. And if I may, I'm actually going to interject a layperson's theory based on my own experiences. From my strokes a few years ago, I have a memory problem. I used to say a short-term memory problem, and it's not now that I realize this. But the problem is there's a different part of the brain if you write stuff down than if somebody just tells you a thing. And the part of my brain where people just tell you stuff is part of what got broken in the strokes. So if you tell me things, I have a mind like a steel sieve, and I may not, 5 minutes later, you might as well not have told me. But if I write it down, I have a better chance of remembering it. So scientists may not be sure why this happens, but my theory is it's because it's a different part of the brain. And so it's helping you because there's multiple parts remembering it.
Right. And if you look at the research in learning and memory, the more passes over the material you have, the better you remember it. And the more different sensory modes you use also increases the memory. So you're doing exactly what you ought to be doing. And particularly if you know that you have a weakness in certain areas, and in my case, visual memory, I use my auditory to supplement my visual and turn my visual into auditory stuff in order for me to remember it. Because if I had to rely on visual memory, I'd be, to quote Clint Eastwood in one of his movies, I'd be shit out of luck. I have no visual memory. So, yeah.
Got it.
So you're doing exactly what you should
what
do.
You're
using more parts of your brain. That's great.
You're
doing exactly what you should be doing. There you go, right?
Yep. Exactly. Okay, so the third suggestion. The Mayo Clinic suggests doing crossword puzzles, using an alternate route to get to work, learning a new language or an instrument, or volunteering with a new community organization, anything out of the ordinary. What they're pointing at is something that requires a little bit of crunchy thinking that you're not used to. Push yourself and do something you totally don't have experience with, because that will help your brain to stay tuned up and work better. The fourth suggestion is sleep. We hear this a lot. We blow it off. Stop blowing it off. I'm serious. Get some good sleep.
Yep.
Current theory
suggests
that during sleep, the brain is at work consolidating our memories for us. This is one of the things that heals when you're sleeping properly. So it's sorting through what we need to keep in the brain from what we don't. Because you go through a day, but you only remember certain parts of it a week later. So the brain went through and it filtered your email for you and kept the parts that matter. And so you need good sleep to remember things properly. I'm sure you guys remember that. Well, I'm sure you realize, rather than remember, that if your sleep is really crappy, you keep forgetting stuff. And then you get aggravated and it just spirals. So, and five, related to that, exercise. Again, with the yes, we've heard it 1,000 times, we don't take it seriously, I'm kicking you in the butt, go take it seriously, please. Physical activity increases blood flow to the brain, which can help improve memory and even reduce our risk of dementia. The process of exercising and, you know, getting warmed up and doing a thing and cooling down is a blood flow exercise, and those parts of your brain involved with memory need you to go do that because they're not exercise muscles. They're up and stuck in your head. They're up in your cranium. So you cannot just go out and go to the gym with them. You have to do your exercises.
Yeah. It's also getting more oxygen. It's also getting more oxygen to your brain. Right. And you're sweating out contaminants as well and circulating them out of your system. So it is, I tell everybody to have, particularly depression and anxiety people, three things you can do the best: sleep, get restful sleep, exercise, and watch your diet.
Yeah. And the last suggestion is to be social. And I know for some of you this is hard or annoying, but nevertheless it helps and it works. So if you're having trouble, try it out anyway. Make yourself go do it because it will help you. Interacting with our friends and peers is known to ward off depression and other stressors which have been linked to memory loss. When you're really stressed out, you can have memory loss issues because the chemicals of being stressed, if cortisol gets really batshit in your system, it will screw up your memories. So be social, and if you don't like any people, just go out to a place that you like that's out in public, that's not at your house. And just be out there and people watch. You don't have to talk to them. But be out in that environment and interact with it a little bit. You know, pet a puppy or something. So, of course, we can also employ tricks to help us remember certain pieces of information. We can make lists, use mnemonic tricks. You know, sometimes I'll rhyme a word with somebody's name if it's weird and I can make an association. Limit multitasking. I'm not a professional, and I'm not going to really say that one because I multitask like a fiend. But then again, I have memory problems, so maybe I'm doing myself a disservice. I don't know. And the other suggestion was to link certain memories to colors. I'm not sure why this works, and we're actually at a part where I check in with you, Dr. Mathis. So if you have any thoughts on that you'd like to share, I didn't really get from the webpage why this is a thing, if you happen to know.
It's the same phenomenon with you writing things. It's accessing a different part of your brain. You can also link it to lyrics in a song or a line in a funny movie said by a character whose name you're trying to remember who has the same name as a buddy you just met, somebody you just met. It's that kind of thing.
Okay,
right.
So it doesn't have to be colors, but it's just a different form of information.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Correct.
Okay.
And the other thing I'll tell you is some people are really good at multitasking. Most people are not. Particularly if they're in the memory loss phase, they're not really good at that. My mom was like the bomb multitasking, and even though I have, and I say this with all humility, a pretty high IQ, I don't multitask. If you want me to forget shit, ask me to multitask, and it will like not even get there. It's like, what the hell? That better be Ed McMahon at the door. As far as the exercise is concerned, I'd say cardio is your better exercise as opposed to weightlifting and muscle building. You want to do cardio to get your blood flowing and that sort of thing. The other thing I tell people too, and I mentioned this earlier, I cannot overemphasize the importance of dietary and getting proper nutrition, because if you eat like shit, you're going to slow your blood down, you're not going to get the proper nutrients, and you're not going to remember. You've got to fertilize your brain appropriately, right? The other thing is doing focused meditation or self-hypnosis or, if you will, quote-unquote mindfulness training, that will also help improve your memory, as well as help as a stress reducer, which is the robber of memory. So it has a multifunctional purpose. If you can learn to do that, that's a really, really cool deal.
Got it. Oh, yeah. And if you guys follow us on Facebook, the pinned post at the top of our page has a list of all of our episodes. And one of them about 10 or 15 episodes ago was on mindfulness. So if you're like, I don't know what the hell that is, well, go listen to the episode. That will help you. Okay. So it is getting close to midnight. And that is what I have for you guys this evening. So this will conclude our show on memory. And we hope that our listeners have a better understanding how memory actually works and how it affects our lives so that they can make better decisions and choices based on that understanding. Dr. Mathis, is there anything that you want to say in conclusion before we wrap up?
Nope, I'm really good. I would just say for folks, take your life seriously, take your health seriously. The more proactive you can be now before you start to get memory loss, the less likely there is you're going to get memory loss, barring some,
yes,
you know, major car trauma or, you know, sporting accident or, you know, a stroke or whatever. But if you're in better health, you decrease your risk of doing getting a stroke or a heart attack or high blood pressure or a clot or a multi-infarct or whatever, even if it runs in your family. And if those kind of things run in your family, it's even more important for you to really be proactive and do it early on as a preventative measure against getting it. It's always easier to do it before you get it than it is to compensate after you get it.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, thank you to our listeners this evening, and appreciation also to those of you joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. That's Wednesday, August 8th at 11 p.m. EDT for a new topic brought to you right here on blogtalkradio.com. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.